Will she have to stay in hospital? Can't she come home? I said that I was certain that she would die within the next 24 hours. She would become brain dead, and then the ventilator would be switched off. She's been taken from us so suddenly. We were going to do so many things together in the time we had left, weren't we? Her husband said, turning to his daughter as he spoke. We weren't ready for this. He held his daughter's hand as he talked. I trusted you, he said to me, and I still do. Are you certain that she might not wake up? What if she wakes up and finds that we aren't here? It would be so frightening for her, although I know she kept on telling us last week that she did not want to be a burden to us. But love is unconditional, I said. And he burst into tears again. We spoke for a while longer. Eventually I turned to the door, saying that I had to leave or I would start crying myself. The husband and daughter laughed at this through their tears. As I left, I thought of how I had granted her wish, albeit inadvertently, that she should not die miserably as her father had done. Back in the operating theatre, Patrick was having difficulty stopping the bleeding after removing the disc prolapse in the third and last case on the list. I cursed and abused him half-jokingly and scrubbed up and quickly brought the bleeding under control. We closed up the man's incision together, and afterwards I returned to the ITU to see Melanie. She was peacefully asleep, and her baby son was asleep in the cot beside her. Her observation chart showed that her pupils were now reacting to light, and the nurse looking after her said that all was well. There was a small group of laughing and smiling nurses beside the cot looking at the baby. Her husband rushed up to me, almost delirious with joy. "She can see again. You're a miracle worker, Mr. Marsh. She woke up from the op and she could see the baby. She said that eyesight's almost back to normal and our son is fine. How can we ever thank you enough?" What a day, I thought as I went home. What a day. When I recounted this story, which I had quite forgotten until then, to the Holby City writers gathered round the hotel table, they broke out in little cries of delight and amazement, though whether they used the story about Melanie or not, I do not know. Chapter 5. Tic Douloureux. Plural noun. Brief paroxysms of searing pain felt in the distribution of one or more branches of the trigeminal nerve in the face. Once I had sawn open the woman's skull and opened the meninges, I found to my horror that her brain was obscured by a film of dark red blood that shouldn't have been there. It probably meant that something had already gone wrong with the operation. The light from the battered old operating lamp above me was so dim that I could scarcely see what I was doing. The possible repercussions for my colleague and me did not bear thinking about. I had to fight to control my mounting panic. I was operating on a woman with an agonizing facial pain called trigeminal neuralgia, which is also known as Tic Douloureux, a condition that was considered by her doctors to be inoperable. A television crew was filming the operation for the national news. There were many doctors and nurses looking down on me like gods through the glass panes of a large dome built into the ceiling above the operating table. Many of the panes in the glass dome were cracked and broken, and the view outside through the large windows of the operating theatre was of snow falling onto a grey wasteland of broken machinery and derelict buildings. I often have an audience when operating, and I dislike it when things are going badly, but this was many times worse. I had to radiate a calm, surgical self-confidence, which was not what I felt. This was Ukraine. In 1995, I was 2,000 miles from home, operating without any official permission, probably illegally, doing a dangerous operation on a woman's brain never done in the country before, using second-hand equipment that I had driven out myself from London a few days earlier. My colleague was an obscure junior doctor who had been declared in an interview on the BBC World Service by the senior professor of neurosurgery in the hospital where I was operating to be suffering from schizophrenia. Nor was I being paid to do this. Indeed, it was costing me a lot of my own money. I muttered unhappily to myself as I tried to stop my hands shaking. Why on earth am I doing this? Is it really necessary? I had first gone to Kiev 4 years earlier in the winter of 1992, almost by accident. I had been a consultant for 5 years by then, and already had a large and busy practice. It was a few months after the collapse of the Soviet Union. An English businessman, hoping to sell medical equipment in Ukraine, rang my hospital to find out if any neurosurgeons were interested in joining him on a trip to Kiev. There was a famous neurosurgical hospital in Kiev, and he wanted to take some British neurosurgeons with him to deliver lectures about modern brain surgery and the equipment needed for it. The switchboard operator was rather puzzled by the inquiry, and so put the call through to Gail, my secretary, who has the well-earned reputation of being able to solve most problems. I was in my office, and she put her head round the door. "Do you want to go to Ukraine next Thursday?" "Certainly not. I'm far too busy, and I've got a clinic then." "Oh, go on. You're always saying how interested you are in Russia, and you've never been there yet." Gail is usually the first person to complain if I cancel an outpatient clinic, as she will then have to field all the phone calls from the disappointed and sometimes angry patients and rearrange the appointments. So I had to take her advice seriously. And so, with two colleagues, I travelled to the newly independent Ukraine. There had never really been a separate Ukrainian state before the Soviet Union fell apart, and it was not at all clear what independence would mean. What was clear was that the country was in utter chaos, with the economy close to collapse. The factories were all closed, and everybody seemed to be out of work. The conditions in the hospitals I visited were out of a nightmare. We had arrived in Kiev early in the morning on the overnight train from Moscow. The line crosses one of the long bridges over the great river Dnieper, which flows through Kiev, and as we approached the steep western riverbank, we could see the golden domes of the Lavra Monastery above us, catching the light of the rising sun. A dramatic contrast to the dark railway stations we had passed through during the night and the grim apartment blocks on the outskirts of the city. I had lain in my bunk under a thin blanket, drifting in and out of sleep, listening to the old-fashioned rhythmic sound of a train running over bolted rails, travelling southwards across Russia, stopping at dimly lit stations where I could hear incomprehensible announcements echoing over the empty, snow-covered platforms. It all felt wonderfully strange and yet also strangely familiar, I suppose from the Russian literature in which I had steeped myself in the past. We had only been in Moscow for a few hours, long enough to stand in Red Square in the dark in the falling snow, where, despite the fall of communism, a huge red flag was still flying, a little listlessly, from the Spassky Tower of the Kremlin. Long enough to have a splendid meal in a hotel that one had to enter through three lines of armed security guards, to find long, shabby corridors with worn, thin carpets and a bewildering number of disconcertingly beautiful girls looking for business. Long enough to understand that with the collapse of the ruble, the few hundred dollars we carried in our pockets made us virtual millionaires compared to the impoverished Russians we met. One